Welcome back to After the Buzzer. I'm Gordy Jones. Joining me from a remote location in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, is that Mike Gross. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Gordy. A remote location with plumbing issues.
Oh, no.
That's why we're remote. Everything's fine. Everything's going to be fine.
Make sure you get the water wings up, big guy. All right, and joining us on the line, as this is Super Bowl week, as maybe you've heard, the Chiefs and the Eagles go at it in Arizona this coming Sunday. So joining us is that Jeff Mosher, co-founder of the website InsideTheBirds.com and co-host of the Inside the Birds podcast. Hello, Jeff Mosher.
Hello, fellas. Thanks for having me. I sort of feel extra fortunate today to have, I guess, good plumbing and running water.
Don't take it for granted.
Exactly. So let's start here, Jeff. My feeling is that the Eagles have the better team top to bottom, but on the other hand, Patrick Mahomes, and this is the fourth time Andy Reid will be in this game. I mean, obviously that's a huge oversimplification, but take it any way you want it as far as what you see happening Sunday.
No, I think that's a pretty good way to look at it, right? If it was simply, you know, the Eagles are the better team and the better 53, which they are, then every time, if it just worked that way, where the better team and the better 53 always won, then there wouldn't be great upsets in any level in any sport. So The Eagles are the better team. I do believe that. Now, there are some areas where the Eagles are better that it's comparable, but they're better. For example, everybody loves the Eagles' offensive line, as they should.
Sure.
It's the best offensive line in the NFL.
No
Chiefs
doubt.
Are not that far behind. They have a very good offensive line. Obviously, if you look at tight end, as good as Dallas Goedert is, Travis Kelce's better, but only in a way that Travis Kelce is sort of otherworldly. He freelances routes. He's on the same page with Mahomes in a way a lot of pass catchers aren't, but it's not like a huge gap there, just like the Eagles' offensive line isn't a huge gap
right to
the Chiefs. So really, defensive line, I think where the Eagles probably have the more sizable advantage is their wide receivers compared to the Chiefs' defensive backs, and then also vice versa, Chiefs' wide receivers against the Eagles' defensive backs. The Chiefs have good wide receivers, but they're not explosive playmaking types.
And most of them are hurt. Juju Smith-Schuster has a knee. Kadarius Toney has an ankle/hamstring.
He's got everything. I mean, he can't play 10 snaps without coming on the field.
Right, and Mecole Hardman is doubtful for the game with a pelvis
injury.
He's
actually been ruled out. He was out in the last 10 minutes. He's been put on IR, I think, and they activated Clyde Edwards-Helaire, so there will be no Mecole Hardman.
Well, I wish we had a breaking news klaxon for our podcast, but unfortunately we do not.
Production values.
But Jeff, our friend Shil Kapadia, he wrote this piece for The Ringer with many statistical analyses of the game, and one of the ones that jumped out at me was that Mahomes has made 93 career starts, and in 90 of them, the Chiefs either led or were within one score in the fourth quarter. That's an amazing stat, and speaks to just how good this guy is.
You know what is crazy? I feel like he just got into the league.
Mm-hmm.
I still remember that game against the Patriots. It was 3 or 4 years ago where it was the overtime game where Tom Brady got the ball first.
Mm-hmm.
So they went down the field and scored. Or else, if the Chiefs go to the Super Bowl that year, they probably beat the Rams and they have even more, you know, Super Bowls. And Mahomes already has more than one. And so he seems so young to me. And if he retired today or Monday after the Super Bowl, regardless of what happens, you can make an argument he's a first ballot Hall of Famer.
Yeah, I agree.
He's got like 15 years left that he can play.
Yeah, he's an amazing player. I mean, he's one of these guys. He makes those good off-schedule plays too, which make him so fascinating to watch.
Yeah. And the off-schedule nature between him and Travis Kelce, who plays that position in a very off-schedule manner, which is not normally something you preach for pass catchers to do, is really phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff, there's a lot of sort of injury situations in this game. Lane Johnson, Jalen Hurts, Mahomes himself. Which one are you looking at and saying this might be a big issue? Because we're not doctors and we don't know. We're not sure. But what's your sense of something that the game might swing on in terms of a health thing?
You know, like, I would have said more recently, I would have said, like, you know, maybe as of last week, I would have said Lane, because what he's playing through is such a difficult injury.
Yeah.
Based on athletes who I've had it spoken to, the nature of the position, the type of athlete that he has to block, whether it was Kayvon Thibodeau in the first round or Nick Bosa in the second round. But he has more than exceeded what I thought, to the point where now I'm thinking, all right, maybe that's not the number one health-related question going into this game. Maybe it is Avante Maddox, who played really well last week in coming back also way earlier than expected from a nasty toe injury. He had a surgery on it. I mean, that... And for him to get out there and play, now, why I would say I'm still worried about it is because, frankly, after six plays and the 49ers were down, you know, with zero quarterbacks, the passing game for the 49ers just wasn't as fearsome as you might expect or think if at least Brock Purdy was healthy. Now he's a slot corner going up against Kelce or whoever they motion for however long Kadarius Toney might be able to play. I mean, he's going to be going up against a different caliber of offense here. And if he's still not 100%, we were told he was not. He was playing out there, not at his typical shape, but looking good because, you know, obviously the 49ers have struggled passing the ball. But that could be an area that the Chiefs really try to exploit.
Now, the other thing that I look at is how good the Eagles are at pass rush without having to blitz a ton or without having to devote extra resources to it. So the matchup between the Eagles defensive front and the Chiefs offensive front in a pass rush context, because I'm thinking about the few times that Mahomes really has struggled, it's been for that reason that I've seen him struggle. So what do you think of that matchup? Break down that a little bit for us, and what do you think it swings on, kind of?
Well, Mike, I think that's how the game is determined. If you're correct in saying that the times that the Chiefs have really looked not good, there's really two times that stand out, I think, when Mahomes has not looked great. There was last year against the Bengals in the second half.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then there was the Super Bowl against Tampa Bay, where he was running for his life. Now, I think 2 years ago in the Super Bowl, if you guys remember, they were down four offensive linemen.
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly.
I thought that was more not him making bad decisions, but him under duress from a Todd Bowles defense that just blitzed him and came after him. And I almost felt bad. It just wasn't fun. It's probably how people, you know, who didn't have a horse in the race felt about watching the 49ers in the NFC Championship game. It just didn't look like you knew it was doomed from the beginning. Mm-hmm. But I think last year was a case where what the Bengals did defensively, and they do a lot of things similarly to what the Eagles do, which is they disguise on the back end, they move safe, they spin safeties, they stunt, they don't blitz a ton, they show you one coverage and then work into another coverage. And you saw that in the second half, which they started doing way more in the first half, that Mahomes didn't have that sync with his receivers, whether it's Tyreek Hill or even Travis Kelce, who was confused and he held on to the ball a little bit longer, and that allowed the Bengal pass rush to get on him, to disrupt him, to throw that passing game out of whack. And that, to me, is going to be what the Eagles, that's what the Eagles do in general, and that would have to be, that'll be what determines this matchup, because I don't think all of a sudden Jonathan Gannon is going to wake up Super Bowl Sunday and think he's Todd Bowles and start blitzing at 40-50% of the time. I think he's going to know that he's got a really good front four, and he's got a great back end, and he's going to have to go and try to make Patrick Mahomes sort of confused and not easily knowing where he wants to go with the ball. And then when they do make him hold on to the ball and get him scrambling in and around, they're going to have to do a good job of taking him down.
Mm-hmm. This is another stat from Shiel. He said that the Eagles have had sacks on 11.5% of opposing pass plays, but Mahomes has only been sacked on 3.9% of their pass plays, which is, you know, kind of feeds into what you're just saying.
Yeah, it's
part of that, like, his ability to move around.
Yeah.
It's really, yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, he's had...
Like immovable object versus irresistible force thing. Like, which one gives in?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I going back to that game against Tampa Bay, that Super Bowl against Tampa Bay, yeah, I agree with you. It's like it wasn't a fair fight. But at the same time, it really illustrated a lot about Mahomes' mindset as a competitor, just his ability to try to make plays even though there was very little there, he had very little time to do much of anything. But just the way he kept hanging in there was damn impressive to me, you know?
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, he threw a pass in that game where he was sort of sideways.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
he hit by two guys and threw it like behind him. And, you know, it wasn't one of those cool ones that he does that looks like Brett Favre. It was like one of those, oh my God, I'm getting killed.
Yeah.
And somehow the ball found the target. Yeah.
Yeah, he's really an incredible player in a lot of perspectives. Just his fearlessness and his creativity and his competitiveness. It's really impressive. Just the whole package that's there.
Nothing wear it on his face as much as some other guys. But my sense is that he's really a fierce competitor. That he really is an intense guy. More than the body language might suggest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. I think he has this sort of a charming personality, and you see him on the commercials. But I mean, he's out there playing with a sprained ankle, and it seems like the way the teammates speak of him, you never hear anything bad said, and that they go out there and try to, you know, win it with him, not just with him, but also for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems pretty true. Now, this is one last stat from Shiel. He said that Andy is 23-6. In games where his teams have had at least 10 days to prepare. Now, I guess there's a couple ways of looking at it. Two of those six are Super Bowls, for one thing. And the other thing is, somebody pointed this out, that, you want Andy for the 2 weeks leading up to the game, but you probably want Nick for the 3.5 hours the game is played, just knowing how Andy is with in-game adjustments. What do you think of that point of view?
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. You know, I don't think Andy is the same coach with the Chiefs that he was with the Eagles.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he struggles as much with the time management, the clock management issues, the 2 minute drill issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's more creative, more of a, you know, and he was pretty, you know, ahead of his time here with the Eagles, but he's obviously sort of reinvented himself there in Kansas City. I guess with the stat, though, I would be curious to know how many, because he gets kind of knocked. And deservedly so. There are a lot of big game losses, but how often does he lose as the favorite? Because I know that it's going to add to his sort of anti-legacy if they lose this game, that Andy Reid lost another Super Bowl, lost another big game, but they're not the favorite. So, right. You know, I'm always curious, held against him when he doesn't win when the other team is better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like 2 years ago, that Super Bowl, they were not the better team. They're clearly not the better team.
Right.
So I don't look at that one as that's another kind of rough Andy loss. Maybe last year against the Bengals, but I thought the Bengals were pretty comfortable.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly right. When Gordy said that statistic, the first thing I thought of was, well, to me, that's kind of a positive that he's getting them in the hunt when they aren't necessarily every time the better team. That's exactly what I thought when I heard that.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy, you guys. Like, if you ever listen sometimes to sports talk radio out here closer in the Philly, things just become sort of like an accidental mantra or a trope, I guess. But I heard a caller the other day call in talking about, you know, he didn't like Andy Reid, and he kept talking about the 4 straight conference championship losses. And I'm like, no, they actually won the 4th one. They went to the Super Bowl.
Yes.
But it's just like the whole, like, they didn't win it. So it's like, yeah, some people's mind, like, you lost 4 straight conference championships or 4 straight big games. No, that's not the case, but that's sort of how it is when people are talking about Andy and they look at his record.
Which kind of begs the question, would you rather have 10 years of Andy always being in the hunt, or however many years of Doug where they got over the top? I guess more people would rather have the latter. I guess.
That's a loaded hypothetical, right? Because you already know the outcome.
Right. Right. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like asking someone, would you rather have a great team that's Super Bowl worthy once every 5 or 6 years, or a pretty, you know, a really good team every year that could win a Super Bowl? And then that sort of changes the dynamic of the conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're right. If you end up going the whole way with the Peterson example, then that sort of justifies it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Right. Yeah. Jeff, I'm interested in, you know, obviously Andy and his connection to the Eagles is a storyline. I'm interested in what you're looking at as a guy who's going out there as a podcaster, more of a broadcaster, but a guy who has been a writer and thinks like a writer, how are you thinking about covering this game? And what do you think the storylines are that interest you?
So, I hear a lot of, you know, if you can just contain Travis Kelce, then you really should have a beat on the Kansas City offense. And then the question I would have, though, is, doesn't every defensive coordinator think that going into the game? Especially this year with no Tyreek Hill that they have to really worry about, yet the guy still catches, you know, 7 to 10 passes. But that's sort of like game matchup. I think in general, I can't remember a time where two teams this closely matched went against each other. So I'm really curious to see. There's two things that will stand out to me from a writer standpoint. One of these teams, if not both, is going to do something really sort of gimmicky, goofy, gadgety, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, we had the Philly special in 2017, and then the Patriots also tried to pull some shenanigans in that game, too, with Tom Brady trying to catch a pass, and that didn't work. So these two teams are full of coaches that have been around the block and also known for being pretty innovative. We've seen what Nick Sirianni has done, especially on fourth down. With this team this year, mm-hmm. As far as the quarterback sneak and then working off, you know, tosses and pitches off that. And then, of course, we know that Andy Reid's always got something in his bag of tricks. So oftentimes in these games, those are the critical plays. You know, Philly special came right before halftime, but I don't know if you can really see the Eagles winning that game if they don't pull off that huge fourth down touchdown game in that game from a momentum and just being able to score as many times as you have the ball standpoint. So I look forward to that. In this game, what coach sort of has the bag of tricks and reaches into it first? And then second thing I'd really key in on, because it's always the forgotten element of a Super Bowl, but certainly one of the most important, is special teams. Mm. There's always a return. There's always a field goal. There's always maybe an onside kick. There's always something in a Super Bowl that happens on special teams that helps determine the game. So I would imagine this game will have something in that area that really, you know, helps determine who's the winner or loser.
Interesting, which is why that Hardman injury matters. And also, the Eagles have gotten a little better there later in the year as on specials.
Yes, they have. They've really turned that part around. I remember saying that midway through the season, this team is so good that you would hate for them to have to lose a huge game or a playoff game or, God forbid, a Super Bowl, right? Mm-hmm. Because they gave up and you know, we talk about that penalty that put the Chiefs in position to kick that field goal at the end of the game, but what is forgotten is that was a really long return first that set up the Patrick Mahomes scramble that got him into that position. So any little thing like that can come in really big in the Super Bowl.
Yeah. Obviously, this is the Kelce Bowl with Jason and Travis on either side, both future Hall of Famers, it would appear, and That is a piece. I'm working on a Jason piece, as you know, Jeff, and I've talked to Jamal Jackson and A.Q. Shipley and Brian Baldinger and Ray Dininger about him. And one of the things that I was kind of stumbled on, well, not stumbled on, but just was thinking about, was how unique it is that the center is the face of their team, pretty much. That's really, how often does that happen? You know what I mean?
I mean, there's kicker, there's punter, and then the next one would be the center. Yeah. Being the face of your team. I don't remember the 70s Steelers as much. I don't know if Mike Webster was front and center on that.
No, I don't think so.
There have been some pretty, you know, I guess like a Kevin Mawai stands out to me. Owen Kreutz is a guy you'd see in front of the cameras a few times, but nothing like Jason Kelce. It's really fascinating.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you're looking, I don't mind promoting myself here, but if you need a book filler, I still remember the day at practice in training camp, Kelce's rookie year, mm-hmm. when he's taking first team center snaps, and they had some rookie guard also, and I can't remember, it might have been Danny Watkins, right? I think that was the same class.
Yikes.
Right. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking, wow, it must be one of those, you know, that was the advent of those, like, veteran-type days where veterans get a day off.
Right.
So I tweet something like, must be a veteran's day off for Jamal Jackson, who was the center at the time, and who you talked to, and somebody else, because now there's so forth and so on. Jason Kelce is at center. Mm-hmm. And then it was about 20 minutes later, I get an unsolicited text from Jamal saying, nah, man, this ain't no Veterans Day off. That's your starting center.
Wow. Wow. Anyway,
trust me, this is your starting center.
So
when the season begins.
So how early in camp was that? Just out of curiosity.
It was fairly early. I mean, it wasn't like the first day the pads came out, but I mean, it was not you know at the end of August either. It was probably within the first 10 days of the pads coming out.
I'm using that, man.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty strong. The guy who was getting replaced.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, they knew and I wound up talking to Jamal about it more, about how did you know or what sense did you get, and they knew once Howard Mudd became the offensive line coach, mm-hmm. that Howard had a preference for undersized offensive linemen who moved fast. I mean, he was considered the guy who brought Jeff Saturday, you know, into prominence as the Peyton Manning center with the Colts. And Jeff Saturday is another guy who does not look like a big offensive lineman and wasn't mm-hmm. at the time, but was very athletic and was able to do things that other centers can't the way Jason Kelce can.
All right. Thanks for writing my lead, big guy.
No problem. I know the check is in the mail.
Okay. How many Super Bowls is this for you, Jeff? How many have you done?
You're going to be surprised by this, but this... first of all, I'm actually flying back on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have to do my pregame show here at Rivers Casino in Philly on Sunday.
Mm.
But I've only been... This will only be the second time that I'm even going out to where the Super Bowl is. First time, obviously, being in Minnesota 5 years ago, which I did go to that and cover that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get anything out of the media day sort of feeding frenzy thing where all the players are available?
So that's the Monday like circus one, right? The big the crazy one. Yeah, no, I'm not going to be at that.
Well, that would be today. Then. Yeah.
Yes, that would be today. Right, I'll be headed out to Tuesday evening.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So it's a weird experience for me because I'm there to do interviews for Inside the Birds, and we're going to be doing live stream shows each day, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, from Radio Row. But then people are also asking me to come on and be interviewed for other outlets. So wearing a couple of different hats.
Yeah, that's interesting. Hey, I was thinking about this too. This is one more Mahomes related point. Just about, you know, when they played and beat San Francisco in the Super Bowl, Mahomes was actually having a really poor game until he hit that huge pass to Tyreek Hill late in the game, and then all of a sudden it tipped the entire, but I just think it speaks again to another part of his competitiveness that you may get him down, but you might not necessarily keep him down. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, I think they were down in the AFC Championship game like 17-0 in the first quarter to the Titans, right? And then they wound up scoring like 3,400.
Yeah, something weird like that. Yeah, it really speaks to him, and I guess it also speaks to them once they get their rhythm, once they figure you out a little bit, too.
I would say this. If you're the Eagles and you're in the fourth quarter and you're up, like, you know, let's invent the score here. Let's say you're up 28-24,
mm-hmm.
and Mahomes, there's 2 minutes left and Mahomes has the ball. You're not feeling great.
A field goal would do it, then it's even more so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the Eagles quarterback. He's a story. I would not have believed that he would become. I can't believe how much he's improved in terms of just execution of the passing game and throwing the ball down the field. I didn't see that coming at all. Obviously, you're a lot closer to it than I. Did you see it coming?
No, of course not. Did I think that he could improve? Of course I thought he could improve. But I wasn't even 100% sure as we went into the offseason last year that he would be given that chance to improve. I mean, it's no secret that the Eagles flirted with the idea of trying to go out and get a veteran quarterback on the trade market, and it didn't materialize because, you know, for whatever, you know, Russell Wilson didn't want to go here or there or the other, or, you know, Deshaun Watson had all the illegal stuff still embroiled with him. I mean, there just weren't the opportunities the Eagles might have been looking for at that time. And so, you know, Jalen was their guy, and obviously they did it. I think everybody deserves, you know, the quarterback's coach, Jalen Hurts, deserves an unbelievable amount of respect and credit for improving the offensive coaching staff, because they've redesigned their offense this year to be a more pass-centric offense, but maintaining the running and the RPO structure that really makes it difficult for them to defend, for the opponents to defend.
You know, you mentioned the Eagles' offensive line. The Chiefs have, I think, very few game wreckers on their defense, but one of them is Chris Jones, who's a guy that they're really going to have to keep tabs on. And they kind of move him around and make him an end, make him a tackle, do this, do that. What do you see in him?
You know, it's kind of a freak of nature, because we've seen a lot of defensive ends get moved into the middle and the nickel.
Yeah.
Now, you know, they did that with Brandon Graham during the 2017 season. And you sort of use that burst that you have against the slower guards. Mm-hmm. I think it's a little less common to see a guy who is a natural defensive tackle move outside, play end, and be able to change a game. And his pressure from the edge, last one, and the AFC Championship game against Joe Burrow kind of sealed up that, you know, I think it was a third down sack, right? And they had to punt the ball back to the Chiefs and then wound up scoring. So to have that kind of ability is rare. Fletcher Cox is great, and every once in a while he lines up at the end and, in a formation, but he's not someone who's going to give you a ton of pressures from around the tackle the way Chris Jones has. And Chris Jones also has a ton of quarterback hits. So, when you're talking about guys who are up for Defensive Player of the Year, it's clearly going to be Nick Bosa and Micah Parsons, but he should be in that conversation with Hassan Reddick also, in the top three or top four there.
Yeah. And Brandon Graham's an interesting case, speaking of which. I mean, he had a torn Achilles, and he's come back and really had his best year. I mean, I know they've spotted him some. They have that luxury, but this is quite a bounce back for him, correct?
It's an amazing bounce back. I mean, I thought he was a good candidate for comeback player of the year, had one of his best years. I mean, who would have thought that at this age, coming off that injury, that he would have a career high in sacks? Now, That to me is unbelievable, and it adds to the great story.
Yeah,
the book that you'll probably write after this, right? Jason Kelce, is that here's Brandon Graham, who everybody killed when everybody wanted Earl Thomas, and then the guy that was drafted below him, Jason Pierre-Paul, won the Super Bowl that year, and it made it look even worse when he went out with the Giants, and then it took him a couple of years to really come into his own. And of all the coaches who helped Brandon Graham coming to his own, it was really Chip Kelly. And I'm not crediting Chip Kelly, I just mean it was in that era, right, when they moved him to an outside linebacker and asked him to do things he had never done before, and he did it well, then he suddenly become this really confident player who could go out there and be a leader and just dominate, and then he makes the most impressive defensive play in the Super Bowl to win it for the Eagles for the first time, and here he is, and now he's talking at press conferences like he's going to come back. It's amazing.
It really is amazing, yeah. He and Kelce both, I mean, the narrative is that Kelce should retire after this year, but why? He's really kind of had his best year.
You know? Yeah, I wouldn't retire for any of them.
No.
It's football's fun. It's not a bad way to make.
So who wins, Jeff, and what's the score?
You know, I do think the Eagles are going to win. I think it's going to be a close game, sort of like a 3 or 4 point game in the fourth quarter. And then I see the Eagles kind of scoring a touchdown. I think that they're going to be able to wear down the Chiefs defense with their run and their RPO game, their quick game. I wouldn't be surprised if they did a lot of no huddle early. The Chiefs, I think, as good as defensive they are, they're like any other. Like, if you can wear down the 49ers, you can wear down the Chiefs.
That's true.
I do think the Eagles will have that ability.
That's so true.
If they happen to be able to get a touchdown, if they're up by 3 or 4 in the fourth, and then tack a touchdown onto that, just to make it a little bit more of a lead and not put it all in Mahomes' hands at the end, that's kind of how I see the game unfolding. Like maybe a 37-27 type game.
Interesting.
Maybe that's a little high, but it could be. Yeah.
That sounds about right. You
get the check mark from us.
Oh, great.
All right, before we let you go, in our post-Mosher segment, we were going to tackle the question of whether Kyrie Irving is the worst teammate in the history of team sports. I used to think it was T.O. T.O.'s last year in Philly was your first year on the beat. So, do you think Kyrie has now supplanted T.O. as the worst teammate ever?
Oh, wow. That's a good one. That's a really good one. I mean, people used to say Barry Bonds was the worst teammate. They would never even share any of his intel
Fair.
With anyone because he was afraid that he was on another team.
I forgot about
Boy,
that.
This got to be a pretty good list of worst teammates ever. But that one... See, the weird thing is... What might go against your argument, Gordy, is that somebody somewhere always seems to want to play with him.
Yeah, that's true.
They think he's going to help him win.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, we'll figure out what what Team X couldn't figure out. Well, it hasn't worked that way.
Right, it really hasn't. Yeah, I mean, Kev, but the weird thing is, I mean, you probably could have put Kevin Durant in that conversation.
Well, that's true. That's a discussion Mike and I have had. It's like, if you can't play with a team that has Steph Curry on it, you might want to reassess your life, much less your career. You know?
Yeah, take a hard look at some things.
Yeah. And now Antonio Brown might be back.
Oh, yeah, God. How can I forget him? Oh, my God. There's so many good candidates.
George has got to be in there, right?
Yeah. We start thinking about this, we might come up with some real all-time assholes, you know. But who was the Lemieux that everybody hated in the NHL in the 90s? Claude?
Think so. I mean, I don't know hockey at all, so you might be.
Yeah,
right.
There was somebody who said that they were embarrassed that they shook his hand in the line because they hated him so much. That might be another, because he played for a bunch of different teams too, because people couldn't stand him after a while.
Well, you've given us good grist for the mill there.
Well, you called it the post Mosher segment, so I felt like I should.
But you certainly remember how T.O. would do things like, you know, passive-aggressive stuff like park in the handicap space, or he always had the messiest locker with the boxes out in the middle of the locker. Just like, and in addition to the fight with you, Douglas, and so on and so forth. So.
Yes, I remember a countless number of eye rolls.
Yeah. Like
whenever T.O. did or said something.
Right, how he wouldn't talk to any of the assistant coaches other than David Culley, stuff like
right.
that.
Yeah. Well, you got a good list. You got some good ones.
Well, we appreciate the insight, and we wish you a safe trip out there tomorrow, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk again soon.
Appreciate it, fellas. Have a great one.
All right, take care. Be well.
Take care. You guys too.
Bye. So, Mike, well, I guess the first thing is let's talk about what Jeff said about various Eagles topics. It seems like I think that's a pretty good take about how the Super Bowl is going to unfold. And the Eagles are the best rushing team in football. And as he said, if they could wear down the Niners, they can certainly wear down the Chiefs. I mean, the Niners situation, of course, was skewed somewhat by the fact that they just couldn't do anything on offense. But
yeah, I think their frustration was a multiplier of the wear down factor.
Yeah, for
in
sure.
That game. The Eagles have really had an easy trip to the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
In terms of the way this has played out, having to play the Giants and then having to play the 49ers in the situation that they were in.
Yeah.
That was a big piece of this. Mm-hmm. I just think it's amazing to me how, you know, we came into this season thinking that Jalen Hurts was such a limiting factor for the Eagles, and it has turned out that he kind of is the difference, because he allows them to do this RPO running game thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they can throw it down the field as often. A.J. Brown has a lot to do with that, of course.
Sure.
But that's sort of one of the many amazing things about the way this Eagles thing has unfolded.
Yeah. It was interesting to me. There was a replay in the game against the Niners, and Greg Olsen pointed this out. And the replay was from behind the offensive formation, and they were running an RPO, and Fred Warner stood stock still until he could see what Hurts was doing. And Olsen's point was that the way they run their offense turns guys who can run a 4-5 into guys who are running a 4-7. And, you know, this is Fred Warner, like one of the best linebackers in football, was just totally stock still because he didn't know what was going to happen in front of him. And that was a really...
I remember that play. Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
It is, you know, what bringing it back to Penn State here for a minute. What Penn State was doing with Joe Moorhead, where you put an individual defender under stress, and you make him make a choice, and whatever choice it makes
is wrong.
Is the wrong choice.
Yeah.
That's what the Eagles are doing, except it's much more varied. Mm-hmm. It's much more complicated. It's a much more sophisticated version of that, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Keed, once again, as we all talked about, by the best offensive line in football. I don't think there's any question about it. Those guys are all just, I mean, they're great, but Kelsey is particularly great because I think he sets the standard for the entire group, and he cleans up any messes that that develop. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Lane Johnson might be the best football player.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. I don't know. Kelsey's amazing. But the other thing is their guards are. I mean, you can hitch the plow to those guys too.
Yeah,
those guys are moving the line of scrimmage back 4 yards once in a while against the 49ers, who were supposed to be the best defense. So they are. The offensive line is really the secret sauce in what the Eagles have done.
For sure. This is an interesting one. When I talked to Brian Baldinger about Kelsey, he said that good centers are like plumbers because they fix the leaks. And I think that's certainly true in Kelsey's case, for sure.
And it's a lot of times it's fixing the leaks before the ball snapped.
Yeah, it's a good call.
Looking around and seeing what the leaks could be.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Anticipating where the leaks, that's a good way to look at it. That's excellent. So let's continue our conversation about worst teammate ever. Now, as we know, Kyrie Irving this week forced a trade from the Nets to the Mavericks, which, you know, where he'll play with Luka, which is an interesting scenario in and of itself. But this is the third time he's forced his way out of a situation. He forced his way out of Cleveland right after they won a championship to Boston, then forced his way out of Boston to the Nets. I mean, obviously, it's money-driven. That's the biggest factor here. But the other thing is, it's obvious that this guy will never be happy because the Nets, before Durant got hurt, with Kyrie, looked like they could win the East. But now, I don't know if they're a mess. They kind of did okay in the trade. But that it's just striking to me that this guy is obviously will never be happy.
My opinion on Kyrie is that he is, with every fiber of his being, down to his very core, he's a solo act.
Yeah.
It's not just that he's a bad teammate. It's that he just genetically can't think of himself as a teammate. I just don't think he sees himself as part of a team in a really fundamental way, and I don't think that's, at this point, it's not going away. It's not going to change.
He's not going to change. I mean, it dates back, I was thinking he spent a year at Duke, and he played a few games early in the year, and then he got hurt, and then he came back for the tournament, and he kind of wrecked their team right there, because they were playing well without him, and then when he came back, I forget who they lost to, but it was
I forgot about that. That's right.
Yes, but you're right. I mean, he would be better off playing tennis or golf because it's just... And the problem I have with it is he's an undeniably great player. I've said this before on our pod. I don't know how anybody stays in front of that guy. He's just such a skilled player with such a...
Yeah, that's the thing. It's skill level. I mean, he's very, very athletic, of course. But he's not. There's plenty of crazy athletic guards in the NBA. He has an amazing ability to kind of use his body to create a little space for himself, and he does it so instinctively. He'll put a little shoulder into a guy. He'll stop and go, and he does so many little things. He's crafty and has the physical skill to not just think of the crafty stuff, but do it sort of. And the other thing about Kyrie. That amazes me watching him play. He actually is a fun player to watch.
Yes.
But the thing that amazes me about him is no matter what kind of gyrate, when he's going to the rim, no matter what kind of gyrations he has to do to get there, no matter how off balance he is and what angle his body is at, he finds a way to kind of orient himself to the rim and shoot that soft layup. Like, he never, misses a layup because he was going too fast, or because he tried the triple pump. Mm-hmm. Or I honestly think he's the best I've ever seen at that specific thing. It is crazy because it's not something that you can just say, well, he has this insane natural athleticism, and he just does it naturally. No, there's a lot more to it than that.
I like that.
There's obviously a lot of hard work that went into him becoming the player that he is, but he doesn't see it as a means to the end of a larger team goal or something. I don't know.
So, yeah, I agree with all that, and it's like one of the many things I like about watching the NBA is that very thing, just about how little guys can create that little sliver of space against bigger guys and finish at the rim. I mean, Curry's good at it, but Kyrie's better at that specific thing.
Yeah, that specific thing, he is better. And, you know, it's funny because the NBA has a long history of guys who were sort of solo acts.
Mm-hmm.
Iverson was kind of that, I think. But Iverson really, really, really wanted to win.
Oh, my God, yes.
You know, there's no question about it. You know, think about Pete Maravich. Think about a guy like Calvin Murphy. Mm-hmm. You know, the NBA has a history of this, and it's not entirely a bad thing. But this guy, Irving, he just seems so almost hostile to the idea that he's got to be a teammate. It's really distasteful for a guy who is a great player.
That's an excellent word. It really is, because it's like he is so undeniably great, but then to totally disdain, you know, the other four guys are out there with him, which brings us to the point of, how are he and Luka going to interact? I don't know how that's going to work.
it's hard to imagine. I think there's a small chance that it could turn out to be a positive, much in the way that, to the extent that Kyrie ever thrived in a team situation, it was in Cleveland.
Ah, yeah.
With LeBron, who had the ball all the time and was so much of a showrunner,
mm-hmm.
and that's what Luka is. And maybe Luka needs somebody else, you know, to just take it. You just do the solo once in a while, you know. I'm really reaching, to try and make the defense of this from the Dallas point of view. I'm interested to see what happens there.
I am too.
It could go really bad, but I think there's a small chance that it could turn out to be a good thing. We'll see.
Yeah, well, they needed to shake up their team because the West is so tightly bunched. I mean, they needed to take a swing, I think. That's part of it.
And I don't like watching their team play. No, as great a player as Luka is, I don't like watching.
No, it's like watching the Harden era Rockets. It's just not it's not appealing at all. And there are those who have suggested that in acquiring Kyrie, that the Mavs kind of overcorrected for letting Jalen Brunson go to the Knicks in the offseason, because they probably should have helped. And the other part of this is there are reports out there that Joe Tsai, the Nets owner, wanted very much to screw Kyrie by not letting him go to the Lakers, his preferred destination, which I think is an interesting point of view.
I could be snotty too.
Yeah, exactly. We had another NBA topic we wanted to address, and that is the trade deadline is Thursday. And somebody tweeted today that yesterday, when the Sixers lost to the Knicks by 11,
I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, Montrezl Harrell was a minus 15 in 317, which seems like it should be impossible. but my point is, and this is something I wrote on my blog last week, they need to address the backup center situation, which they have for several years now. They've gone through a bunch of backup centers and always seem to lose the non-Joel Embiid minutes. And that could be costly, and very likely would be costly in a playoff series. So they have to address it either with a trade or in the buyout market. And there are some guys out there that might fill that need better than Montrezl Harrell and Paul Reed.
Well, when you floated the Mo Bamba thing a couple weeks ago, ever since then I've been thinking about that and occasionally getting to watch Mo Bamba play, and that makes more and more sense to me. But I don't know how they can make that.
No, I don't think they can do it.
But the practical considerations.
No, I don't think they have enough to make that happen. They're the other name that probably they can't do. and because it will cost too much, as a guy named Jared Vanderbilt, who was with the Wolves and went to the Jazz in the Rudy Gobert trade in the offseason. And he's not quite a pure center, but he is a big guy. And that's another name that's been thrown out there. And there's reports that the Sixers are sniffing around Nerlens Noel as possibly a buyout candidate from Detroit. That makes some sense.
Yeah, that would be that's not a bad name. I think I would be in favor of that. Again, it always depends on, you know, the numbers and the contracts and the years and all that stuff.
Yeah, so I think Nerlens would make a lot of sense. I mean, when Andre Drummond was in with the Bulls a few weeks ago, he was kind of lobbying to come back to the Sixers. I'm not sure Andre is definitely the answer. He did okay with the Sixers, but I mean, I picture Nerlens as a guy who, you know, the NBA is such a pick-and-roll driven league.
Yeah.
And Nerlens is a guy who could at least stay in front of guards, I think, better than Andre Drummond could. So I think
he can get out in the perimeter and move his feet. At least the last time I noticed, he could.
Yeah.
And you know, you could argue that he's not a center, but how many teams in the NBA have two legitimate centers
Fair.
Or rotation guys?
Fair.
I mean, there aren't that many.
Yeah.
I kind of like that idea.
Yeah.
If it's workable.
Yeah, and it sounds like it would be cheaper. The other thing, the other rumor that's been floated out there, that Keith Pompey, our friend who's been on our pod a couple times, reported that the Sixers have gotten interest from other teams about Matisse Thybulle, the Warriors, Kings, and also apparently the Hawks are interested. But then I looked yesterday, somebody mentioned that the Sixers are 10-0 this year when Matisse plays 20 minutes or more. So I'm thinking...
Oh, yeah, I saw that too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did see that number. Yeah.
So maybe they shouldn't trade him. Maybe they should just play him more, you know?
Yeah. It's probably possible to go overboard with those kind of statistics.
Yeah.
He frustrates me.
Yes.
Because he's so limited offensively.
Yeah.
And he seems like a guy who would be a pro and would want to work at it. And it seems like he's athletic enough that if he worked at it, he could be a serviceable offensive player. But he's not.
If anything, he's gone backwards. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He looks less sure of himself whenever he catches the ball, like wherever he catches the ball. It just looks like it's just not... It's almost not a mechanical thing, but more of a mental thing at this point.
As Bill James used to say, players as they age, they tend to get more entrenched in their strengths and their weaknesses.
Interesting.
You know, and that sort of feels like what might be happening with him. He ever increasingly thinks of himself as a specialist.
Which is kind of a shame, because, you know, I was kind of hoping that he would advance some. Maybe he's one of those guys who would benefit from a change of scenery. I don't know. I mean, you could look at it a number of different ways. I do know this, that if he ends up with the Warriors, they're going to make him into Andre Iguodala 2.0. That's what's going to happen there. Kind of is, but I mean, I'd be happy for Matisse because he is a good guy. He's a hard worker. So, I mean, maybe this is what he needs for his career to advance. Maybe it's just not going to happen in Philly. Maybe it's just one of those deals. You know what I mean?
Yeah, maybe. I'm not anti-Thybulle, but
no.
I'm frustrated by Thybulle.
Yeah, I am too, because I really thought that he would develop the other end of the court better than he has, because it's just not happening at all. Last thing for the good of the order is that Del Jackson, the book, you and Del Jackson are the co-authors, and I was a contributor to this book about 50 years of LL basketball, and it is now out, which is exciting, I think, and it's gotten a... I know on social media it's gotten a positive reception.
It really did get a pretty big hit when he tweeted a picture of the cover and people really reacted to it. I hope people want to buy it.
I hope so too.
It was a pretty good project to work on, and I think something worth doing. And Dow has a lot invested in it. I mean, I think it's a little bit of a misnomer that I'm on as a co-author, because it really is Del's thing, and you and I were both happy to help him with it. It's pretty good. It's pretty cool. If you have any interest at all in high school sports in our part of the world, and certainly basketball in our part of the world, I
Yeah.
I would recommend it to anybody.
Yeah, I thought it was, I mean, you and I both read it all the way through, and there's a lot there. As you've mentioned before, it's like you can pretty much, you know, drop in anywhere in the book and find something that might appeal to you if you're a basketball fan from our area. So that's kind of cool.
And somebody responded to the tweet, and I thought this is pretty dumb, but somebody responded to the tweet and said, "What? This looks like all the images on the cover are from the last 5 years, and well, it doesn't look like you're going to be representative of the whole 50 years. Well, that's nothing could be further from the truth.
Oh, my God, yeah.
A ridiculous statement, and probably, I know that the images on the cover were a factor of looking at the quality of the images.
Sure.
And looking at the availability of the images, not to fail to be representative of.
Oh yeah, I mean to me, I mean that's one of the things I really enjoyed about being in this project. I talked to people that I literally hadn't talked to in 40 years. You know?
Yeah, that's right. We did get to revisit some of those guys. Some of those guys were really fun to talk.
Oh about. Yeah,
and it was fun to see. I think it was fun for them too.
I hope so.
To
I hope so.
On everything and sort of think about their career and. Yeah, so it's going to be a good thing. And it would be the kind of thing that I think every school in the Lancaster-Lebanon League would want to have this book in their library.
I hope so. I hope so. Because
so that's one sales.
Well, put it out there, big guy.
Yeah, there you go.
So, but I agree with you because I do think there is something in there for everybody. Literally everybody. I do.
And lots and lots of records.
Yep.
League playoff records, section standings, coaching records. You know, Dell did all decade teams.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the 2,000 point scores, the 1,000 point scores, on and on and on. So,
yeah, it's a lot there. Yeah, so it was definitely a worthwhile project, and I was happy to be a part, as I know you were. And so I look forward to seeing the hard copy myself, you know?
It's coming.
Anyway, I think that's all I had for the good of the order. Mike, you have anything else?
I'm good, my man.
All right, so we will be with you again next week. I'm Gordy. That's Mike. We'll see you later.
See you later.